It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Wednesday. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk about how whitefish are returning to some Wisconsin rivers after being absent for over a century. First, a new report out from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looks at higher levels of estrogenic compounds in well water in northeastern Wisconsin. Why are they there? Where do they come from? Not quite sure yet. Researchers think there could be a tie to all the dairy farmers in that region. Kate Golden joins us now to give us the details. She's a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So what hormones are we talking about, or what kind of compounds are we talking about in these wells in northeastern Wisconsin?
The short answer is we don't really know. So the researchers looked at well water in areas that already had a history of contamination. So it's not a random sample in these karst areas where water travels super fast straight into the groundwater from surface. It can often be contaminated. And what they found, they looked at chemicals. They looked for chemicals that would basically make breast cancer cells in the lab proliferate. So it's a hormone-sensitive breast cancer, and if you feed it hormones, then the cancer cells grow. So whatever was in the water made the cancer cells grow, and there were very slight amounts. It wasn't enough to tell people stop drinking their water, but it was enough to be worrisome.
Mm-hmm. And this is a controversial part of the story, I know, but where are these compounds coming from, or what's the mystery behind where they're coming from?
The mystery is that there are a lot of things that act like estrogen. So it could have been actual estrogen on cows in that area. There are tons of cows, way more cows than people. They produce a lot more waste than people. There's in Kewaunee County alone, I think the stat I used was that there's like 36 times more waste from cows than people there. But people take birth control pills, the estrogen, you know, there are lots of industrial chemicals and personal care products and municipal sludge, and there's all sorts of chemicals that act like estrogen. So even though dairy farms and manure and pesticides are quite likely because of the volumes being put on the land, we really don't know what the chemicals were.
And the thought is this karst region that you mentioned, that the topography here, the landscape, makes it likely that possibly manure would have runoff that would quickly go into the groundwater supply. That's one of the possible culprits researchers are talking about.
I mean, that's already happening in this mm-hmm. area. That is an issue in this area. You know, this is a particularly contaminated part of Wisconsin. The wells in the town of Lincoln, 51% of the wells tested were unsafe due to either nitrates, which are connected to agriculture, or bacteria, coliform bacteria. They're an indicator of some sort of contamination. In the rest of the area, it's more like maybe 30%, but not everybody tests their wells.
And how big a problem is that? Is that something that the DNR say, or local governments are trying to get people to do more?
When I talked to local government officials, they said, you know, we don't know what effect this estrogen stuff has, but if your article does one thing, it will make people go out and test their wells.
And they could be testing for other things like E. coli, I think you mentioned in your article.
Yeah. If you test for bacteria and nitrates, that's kind of a basic thing to look for. And you come back with a positive for coliform bacteria, then you might want to go back and test for E. coli. If you live in an agricultural area, you might want to do a pesticide screen. There are metals to look for. Those are the big ones.
One of the concepts you introduced, or introduced me to, at least in the coverage, is the manure to cropland ratio. What is that, and how does it play into the water here?
Yeah, it was a new one for me, too. It basically describes how much acreage you have to spread the manure on. Manure is both a nutrient, it helps farmers, and it's also a waste. It's something you have to get rid of. And you know, now that we have concentrated farming more and more, we have thousands and thousands of gallons of manure to deal with in Wisconsin. I think Gordon Stevenson, who used to run the runoff management section, estimated that Wisconsin cows produce more manure than the people in Mexico City and Tokyo produce waste. So that's a lot of manure, and we need some place to put it. And sometimes it goes into digesters and things like that, but basically it gets spread on the land, and the less land you have, the more likely that you spread too much. or you spread when you shouldn't.
Getting back to the estrogenic compounds, these things that in at least some ways behave like estrogen, one of the health concerns here is that these can be endocrine disruptors, right? I hear about those in various environmental stories. What does that mean? What can they do to us?
Right. So we don't know, but endocrine disruptors, so the endocrine system has, hormones flip the switches of your body's functions. It affects growth and regulation, development, your energy levels, all sorts of things. So endocrine disruptors are thought to be connected to hormone-related cancers, breast cancer, thyroid cancer, things like that. But they're also connected to a lot of other potential diseases. And scientists are still kind of figuring that out. With fish and wildlife, it's a little better known. We know that certain endocrine disruptors can feminize fish. They make male fish produce basically egg yolk proteins, and they start to do things that normally only females will do, things like that.
Now, you mentioned that the amounts of these estrogen-like compounds in the water don't, they themselves aren't enough to warrant a don't drink this warning.
Right.
Is there a concern about a cumulative impact, from the water, the well water, and other sources in our lives?
Yeah, we are being constantly exposed to endocrine disruptors. If you look at the antibacterial soap in the bathroom, it's got triclosan that's thought to be an endocrine disruptor. The flame retardants in your mattresses are most likely endocrine disruptors. We have our own, the more estrogen you're exposed to in your lifetime, the greater your risk for certain types of hormone-sensitive cancers. We are surrounded by these chemicals, and the amounts in the well water are very, very slight, but what concerned the researchers was this cumulative exposure.
What's the next step for the researchers at UW-Green Bay who are looking into this?
I don't know if there are going to be follow-ups. The next obvious step would be to take those well water samples and run them through some instruments that can tell you not just what the water can do, that it can exert some estrogenicity, but tell you what those chemicals are so you'd have an idea of what the source is. Is it estrogen produced by cows? Is it, hormones? Is it the ethinyl estradiol, the synthetic birth control pill from leaky septic systems? We don't know. But when I talked to the researchers, they didn't have access to that kind of equipment. They didn't have the money for it, and they would like to follow up, but they didn't have immediate plans to do that.
With the manure issue in particular, are there things that the DNR is doing or the State Ag Department is doing to try to deal with runoff into water supplies? Or is that still an open question?
So there are standards for, and like large farmers, CAFOs, who have, they have the confined animal feeding operations of 1,000 or more animal units, that's 700 dairy cows. They have to file these nutrient management plans that have very specific instructions on what they're going to do, how much manure they will apply where, how they're going to store it, things like that. There is a lot of controversy over that in northeastern Wisconsin because the land there is so vulnerable to contamination. A lot of the fissures in the ground and the karst features where water and runoff can just go straight down, they aren't necessarily visible on the surface. And there's controversy because basically there is very little enforcement of nutrient management plans. It is a complaint-based enforcement, and there aren't, the goal is to get one inspector every 5 years. I'm not sure that the DNR is actually making that goal.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Kate Golden, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Up next, we'll learn why whitefish are returning to some Wisconsin rivers after more than a century and what this could mean for the habitat. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Whitefish are returning to Wisconsin rivers. Over a century ago, the whitefish left Wisconsin's inland tributaries and has since primarily been fished in Lake Michigan. Now, they're returning, and it's created a bit of a puzzle for scientists. Whitefish are enjoyed in restaurants around Wisconsin, exported nationally, too. Here to discuss the comeback is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's environmental reporter, Lee Bergquist. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be on.
When did the whitefish start coming back to these rivers? And which rivers, I should ask first, are we talking about?
Well, there's four rivers that are where scientists and where biologists with the Department of Natural Resources and are seeing them. It's the Menominee River, the Oconto, Peshtigo, and the Fox. All of those are in northeastern Wisconsin, on the Green Bay. All of them are tributaries to the Green Bay. It really began on the Menominee River way back in 1993, but it was just a few fish, just a very few whitefish. And it really, until this year, there had been no other credible signs where there were spawning fish in any other river. And then this year, starting this fall, biologists began doing some more investigative work on other rivers because they had heard kind of anecdotally that there might be some whitefish on these other fish. And lo and behold, they came across them in all four of these rivers.
Now, they used to be common, right? But they disappeared over something like 140 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. They were on the Menominee, for example. They were from all the data that, or all the old information that the DNR was able to glean. They were essentially gone by 1890, and since then, they were just gone, and then we've started to see this return of them, and. I think what I heard was that, you know, at that time, when you're on that river at Marinette, there was a huge timber industry, sawmills, a lot of activity on that river, and just the river was silted in. There wasn't the habitat that you see today.
And I see that at least the Menominee River itself has been part of a big rehab project from the DNR and then the cities of Marinette and Menominee, Michigan. How much progress have they made cleaning out those pollutants you were just talking about?
Well, I think they've made, I think, you know, if you probably would ask an ardent environmentalist that lives in the area, they would say it's not fast enough. It should have been done a long time ago. But there has been efforts to some cleanup work on that river. And I think the proof is that you have whitefish returning to that river. If there wasn't much cleanup work, on the Menominee, mm-hmm. that you wouldn't have this situation. Now, when you speak about cleanup work, really where a lot of the effort is on the Fox River in Green Bay, where you have the largest PCB cleanup project in the country. That's polychlorinated biphenyls, and they've cleaned up. They've spent. Well over $100 million on that project so far, and they still have several years of work to before they'll be done.
So when whitefish start moving back into a river, maybe it's too soon to answer this, I don't know, but are they just coming up to spawn and then heading back out to Lake Michigan, or are we seeing resident populations of whitefish staying in the river forever?
No. I think it is my understanding that there. It's primarily it's for spawning. They're lake. They're generally lake residents, but and until this phenomena happened, they were just spawning in on reefs in Green Bay or out in Lake Michigan in certain areas, and they were spawning there. Now they're moving into these lakes, into these rivers, and they are going to spend, let's say, maybe a month in those rivers, and then they will, they will spawn, they'll do their business, and then they'll return back out to the lake. I think what's notable about that is that as the environment changes, as the ecosystems change, as things change, if you have that many more places where they're going to be spawning, and they're spawning in their original area in rivers where they were believed to have spawned, you know, decades and decades ago, that's going to make for a stronger species in the long run.
How far upstream are we finding these guys so far?
So far, just a few miles. And in fact, on the Menominee, it's really only about a mile because there's a dam at that river. If that dam wasn't there, then they'd probably be farther up. And from what I understand, that on the Ocano and the Peshtigo, it's just, you know, like a mile or so. With the Fox, it's probably farther up. It's probably several miles up the river at the Fox at the city of Green Bay.
You mentioned the Menominee River having pollutants. I assume the Fox River as well. There's still a thought that there's still work to go on all the rivers we're talking about as far as pollution. Is that right?
Oh, sure, sure. We've, as a society, we treated rivers as open sewers for many, many years, and we really, did a lot of damage to them. And you know, beginning in 1970 with the Clean Water Act, where regulations went into place, things slowly began to turn around. The big area, of course, was these restrictions that were placed on wastewater treatment plants so that you couldn't just dump, effluent right directly into the river. They have to be treated first. And, you know, what's happening more so now is the non-point pollution parts of things, some of the material that's washing off from our streets and from farm fields, and there's some attempts to try to restrict what flows into the river, and that's all going to be helping these rivers as well in the future.
With the whitefish, one of the sub-puzzles of the big puzzle is that there are invasive species that researchers thought would make it hard for whitefish to come back. They seem to be doing okay around them. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. My colleague Dan Egan, who spends a lot of his time covering the Great Lakes issues, has written a lot about this as well. But these fish whitefish used to eat something called diaparaya, and it's a tiny shrimp-like creature that zebra mussels and quagga mussels, which are invasive species, basically wiped out a lot of these things. So that affected whitefish populations, but somehow, and nobody really has a good answer for this yet, but somehow these whitefish began to change their appetites. They're now finding that they eat alewives, gobies, some of these same mussels, these invaders, they're eating those. And so that allowed the populations to increase again. And as those populations increased, they became very, beginning in about 2006, 2007, they became very popular for ice fishing on the Green Bay side, and populations rose. And that may be one explanation, this rising population, why these fish are moving from up into these tributaries.
The researchers you talked to, they've seen them in these four rivers. Are they saying, hey, maybe we should be going up and down the lake trying to find these guys in other rivers?
Yeah, I think that's the end game, is they want to look in other rivers to try to find them. And they do surveys from time to time, and they have done surveys in the past. They're looking for whitefish, on the Michigan, on the Lake Michigan side, from Green Bay down to Milwaukee, but they've seen no evidence of that whatsoever, and it's kind of a riddle as to why it is just in that area at this point. Probably just because there's, a lot of whitefish in the Green Bay area, I don't think anybody has knows. I think that's where more research needs to be done.
We'll give you more stories to cover and us more things to talk about as they try to track that. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Lee Bergquist. He's environmental reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll hear how more people are living alone and spend some time talking about why they're living alone. Maybe we'll hear your story as well along the way. We'll also take a look at the practical uses of the radio. You know how you use it here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to visit countries with limited infrastructure like Tanzania, where radio can be the one vital link between communities and the whole rest of the world. And we'll continue our Teach Me What You Know segment. We just started that a few weeks ago. We've learned to meditate, right? We learned to start a business. Tomorrow, we're going to learn how to winterize our homes for us late starters out there. That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time. There's still more to come after the news today. Right after the news, 2013 is nearing an end, and we'll explore the baby names that got your attention this year. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, our guest will put a human face on the Syrian refugee crisis and tell us how over 2 million displaced people are changing the Middle East. First, there might be no better cultural barometer than baby names. They give us a window into what was popular in a given year. And as we approach the end of 2013, we thought it'd be a fun time to check in and see what's hot and what's not when it comes to names. Here to tell us about some of the top names and trends of the past year is Laura Wattenberg. She's the creator of BabyNameWizard.com. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, we don't have the final numbers from the Social Security Administration. They tally all the names, I gather. But based on what you've seen, what are your leading contenders for the names of the year for boys and girls?
I think that some of the hottest names in America are actually Wisconsin-style names this year. Hmm. Wisconsin has its own unique twist on the national trends, a little bit more classic but quirky. So not necessarily James and Elizabeth, but more like Nora and Owen. And this year, the two names I would look for as fast risers are Leo for boys and Penelope for girls. I think you'll see a lot of them where you are.
That seems like it's an ongoing trend where a name will disappear for a while, it'll sound old-fashioned, and then it gets resurrected and cool again somehow. Why do you think that happens?
I think that we need to wait for the name to get out of our system. So our own names sound ordinary. Our parents are boring. Our grandparents are old. Then by the time you get back to your great-grandparents' time, you didn't hear all those names growing up, so they sound fresh again.
Yeah, Great Aunt Penelope, maybe we remember her. Great-great Aunt Penelope is an interesting historical figure, and we can name somebody after her again.
Exactly. And meanwhile, your grandparents will be horrified that you're using such an old-fashioned name.
It is really a generational thing, isn't it? Do we have a real generation gap when it comes to names?
There's a huge generation gap, and that's always been the case. We're always, whatever names our parents think are the hottest are the names that we think are most boring. But that's accelerating because the pace of change is accelerating. There literally is no more normal today. The typical American child now gets a name that would be surprising to people in much of the country. So the average names today, statistically, are names like Paisley for girls and Giovanni for boys.
See, and when somebody's naming somebody that name, and this is true with one of my daughters, we're thinking, ah, that's an approachable name, but unique, until you get to school and find five other kids with that same unique name.
It's really disconcerting. Our name taste feels completely personal. You
right.
don't know why you like this. It's not like there are billboards on the highway telling you, you must name your daughter Violet. But it's in the air, and whatever sounds good to you probably sounds good to your friends and neighbors.
Is it harder to name kids in modern times? Because in some countries, in some times, you look on the calendar, which saint is it today? Okay, that's the name of my kid. Or we've been alternating these two names in family history for five generations. Which was John or Paul next, or whatever it might be? We've got so much choice now.
It is absolutely harder. Think of it like shopping for toothpaste.
20 years ago, you go to the store and you say Crest or Colgate. Today, you can just be paralyzed. There are dozens of indistinguishable varieties of Crest and Colgate, and parents are facing the same thing. Is it Braden or Jaden or Hayden or Caden? And there are 20 spellings of each.
The paradox of choice. I've seen that, and I think you referenced it in a piece you wrote a while back.
Absolutely. We think that choice makes it easier for us because we can get whatever we want, but it actually just not only makes it harder to choose, but makes us feel less secure in the choices we make.
And I'll say it's true for naming children, and it's true for naming a new radio talk show. We had pages and pages of potential names before we finally ended up with the one we had, and it worked fine. We probably would have been fine with 30 of the other ones, too.
And that's a good lesson for parents, too. There isn't necessarily one perfect name. You just need a name that makes you happy.
Do people end up with buyer's remorse on a name sometimes, do you think?
I hear that more and more from parents each year. I get really heartbreaking letters from parents who are probably struggling already to, you know, up late with a new baby, and now also worried that the name they chose was wrong, in some cases because they put too much pressure on themselves. Most little infants are just not going to be a Nathaniel or an Anastasia yet. Give them some time.
Do you think, looking at the top names of a year and the rising names, does it tell us something about ourselves? Is it a cultural barometer?
I think of names as a kind of fossil record of culture because it's a really honest indicator. There's no commercial pressure. Parents take the choice seriously, and it really records our hopes and our dreams. So today, with the movement toward more unusual names, I think parents are trying to position their kids for success. They sense that getting attention is the way to get ahead.
Let's get to some of the other names that are popular or on the rise. Let's start with the girls first, if that's okay.
Sure. The hottest trend there, it's for boys and girls, but especially on the girls' side, is we can't stand consonants. Any kind of letter sound that makes your makes your tongue stop is out for girls. So the fastest risers are names like Aria and Mila that sort of flow like liquid.
Okay. And boys, you're seeing some of the same thing too?
We are. Actually, a great pair of names to look at is Mila and Liam. It's perfect anagrams for boys and girls that are rising fast.
So
the
hot
letter on the boys' side, I'd say, is O. So whereas Liam was the fastest riser last year, you might look at Leo this year.
I'm not thinking very creatively right now. What kind of names does that mean we're avoiding?
Well, the ultimate names we're avoiding are the Germanic names like Mildred and Gertrude. But we're also avoiding things that we don't even realize. So, for instance, on the boys' side, a third of American boys now get a name ending in N. That it's an incredible, unprecedented trend.
Wow.
And we come to that from all different ways. So one family is looking at biblical names like Ethan and Nathan. Another is looking at maybe presidential surnames like Jackson and Lincoln. But we all end up with those same sounds sounding good. And that bumps a lot of other names off the table.
And Wisconsin's capital city, Madison, I believe, has trended up in recent years.
And Madison ended up on the girls' side through the pure historical accident of the mermaid movie Splash, where the mermaid named herself after Madison Avenue in New York.
Oh, okay. And that a lot of people, I wanted to run with that a little, the pop culture influence over names. You mentioned Arya, which is a prominent name in the Game of Thrones books and now TV series. And the author I know, George R. R. Martin, has a picture page where people put up babies they've named after his characters.
My favorite Game of Thrones name trend is Khaleesi, which is the title.
It's a title in the book. Yeah,
yeah, it means queen in Dothraki, which a language he invented. And that now is actually starting to rise low on the charts, but we're seeing babies named Khaleesi.
I don't know. If you know what that means, that could give you a bit of an attitude about yourself, I think. Yeah.
Well,
you're named the queen. Everybody bows and scrapes to you.
Plenty of girls named princess out there.
Well, and how about the Hunger Games and Katniss? Am I saying that right? Are people going with that one?
That's a great example of how names aren't influenced by pop culture. And celebrities have a huge influence, but it's really more about the name than the fame. So the Hunger Games for the last 2 years has been one of the hottest properties out there. The heroine is named Katniss. No kids are getting named Katniss. No kids are getting named Peeta after the love interest, because that's just not what we're looking for. But at the same time, last year, the fastest rising name in America was Cataleya, which was the heroine of a movie about an assassin. Made almost no impact on culture, but the name struck a chord.
So then it can't just be a popular thing. The name itself has to be close enough to something you might have named a kid anyway.
Exactly. So once Madison started to decline, Addison seemed just right.
Yeah, and I know when Star Wars came out, I bet there were some Lukes, maybe some Leias, not a lot of Obi-Wans.
Exactly.
We're talking with Laura Wattenberg about the top baby names of 2013, and we want to hear from you. What names have you noticed becoming popular this year? If you work in schools, is there a cohort of different name changes coming through your grade? If you recently had, and hopefully eventually named, a baby, what name did you choose? What influenced your decision? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickett will be back with me on Wednesday. We're talking about the top baby names of the past year. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a name you have a question about? A name that you've seen and thought, oh, that's unusual, but kind of cool or kind of weird? Are you looking for a name? If so, congratulations, and let us know what is in the running. 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. You can ask questions of our guest, Laura Wattenberg, creator of BabyNameWizard.com, and she's the author of the book, The Baby Name Wizard. We'll go to the phones now. We have Jacob with us in Viroqua. Jacob, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jacob?
I've noticed the name Jackson. I volunteered at the elementary school. It's a more traditional name, but it's spelled J-A-X-E-N, a little more untraditional.
All right, so Jackson, but a different spelling. What do you make of that, Laura?
Yes, Jackson is rising in all of its spellings, lots of spelling with an X. Partially, that's just a national love affair with the name, with the letter X. So Every name like Max or Uniforma or Alexis. But there's also a video game character named Jax, J-A-X. And a lot of parents are choosing the X spelling to get that as the nickname.
To get Jax, the video game character, as a nickname. Interesting. So sound-alikes, but they spell them differently. Is that common beyond Jackson and Jackson?
We're seeing different spellings all over the map. And part of the reason is that we're moving away from traditional names, that you're just not going to spell Henry with an I-E at the end. That is, once you choose to name a son Braden instead, then there is no standard spelling and parents get creative.
Thanks for the call, Jacob. Here's a caller with an interesting name. Serenity is with us in Le Sueur, Minnesota. Serenity, hi.
Hi.
So first of all, tell us the story behind your name, if you would, and then we can move on to the ones you actually wanted to bring up.
Yeah, so my parents named me after the Serenity Prayer, which they prayed a lot during their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually usually go by the names Ren or Rennie.
Rennie, okay.
Which is an abbreviated form of Serenity.
Interesting. And then what names did you want to bring up or ask about?
Well, I've noticed that, like, place names have become really popular, like Dallas and Alaska, Paris, London, all sorts of names like that you hear just out of the blue.
Interesting.
Kind of interesting. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for the call, Serenity. Well, I think of Indiana Jones, but that was a nickname within the movie. There was a London Fletcher, a football player. I think he's maybe still in the NFL. Oh, what do you make of that? Place names as people names?
I think place names fill a certain role, that if a parent wants something that sounds fresh and creative, but that people will recognize, they'll know how to spell and pronounce, place names are a great way to get that. And just on the name Serenity, the interesting thing is when that caller was born, I'll bet that name raised a lot of eyebrows. Serenity is now a top 100 name for girls in the United States.
Really? Wow. Okay. Well, that's one to watch for. And by the way, speaking of place names, Atlanta emails, I was wondering how often your guest has come across my name, Atlanta. My nickname is Addie.
I think that that's really an underused name, that Georgia and Savannah are both hot names, but Atlanta, we don't hear much.
That's right. The cities get all the fun, but not the state in that case. Thanks, Atlanta, for that email. Thanks, Serenity, for your call. We'll go to Lance with us in Milwaukee. Lance, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What names are on your mind?
Well, we actually had a baby girl the 6th last week, Friday.
Oh, just congratulations.
Yeah, and we went with the first name is Harper, mm-hmm. and her middle name is Eleanor after my wife's grandma.
So and why Harper, if I can ask? Not that I'm judging. It sounds like a great name.
Yeah. we liked the name, and we started off by kind of figuring out what the top 20 or 30 names are or so and completely crossing those off the list because we didn't want to have a child that was one of many in her school. We wanted her to have a unique name. It was a name that we liked the sound of, and we went with it.
Lance, thanks for the call, and welcome to Harper, Eleanor. So is Harper common, Laura?
Harper is, it's not super common, but it's a very hot name today. It has that androgynous surname sound, but still feels feminine because the Harper that most of us think of is author Harper Lee, who is a woman. Mm-hmm. But I think that's interesting the way they said they went about choosing that name, the idea that you cross off everything popular, which shows just how hard this decision is. I mean, imagine if you went into a restaurant and crossed off all the items on the menu that everybody likes best. That's what we're all doing to ourselves. We're looking for something that everybody likes but nobody uses.
And you mentioned taking that name from the family, Eleanor, and planting that as the middle name. Is that pretty common?
The more common, I think, than ever before, because we're so focused on style today. If we might love our grandparents every bit as much as past generations did, but we're not willing to sacrifice first name style to name after those grandparents.
We'll go back to our callers now. We have Lynn with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. Yeah, it's just Lynn Ann. My mother was a minimalist. I'm 58 years old. We had 3 syllables in our last name, and she thought there were too many syllables to utter to do anything fancy. My daughter, his name is Magdalene. It's Magdalyn after a great grandmother of mine, Magdalene, and then her middle name. Also, my great grandmother's Elizabeth, and our last name contains 4 syllables. But I wouldn't. I'm into naming after relatives, but I wouldn't have named after Magdalene's husband, Clement, because to me, growing up in northern United States, it's just a little bit kind of southern cartoonish to me.
Huh. I mean,
so we do have prejudices built into what we name our children.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lynn. So a lot of considerations there. First, number of syllables. Laura, do you think people are juggling that if they have longer last names? They balance it out by going for a shorter first name?
It is a full composition. It's almost like composing a little line of poetry to have the first and last name. One mistake, though, is sometimes parents love a name, a first name that doesn't go with their last name, and they'll choose a middle name to fix it, except you never use that middle name. It's just you have to make the first name work.
And she also mentioned regional meanings of names or prejudices of names. Clement, she didn't want to pull from the family because it sounded more southern than Wisconsin.
It's interesting that she hears Southern. I think of Clement Clark Moore, the author of Visit from St. Nicholas. But every name does call up a whole world of associations. It really is full of meaning. You see that when the Pope chooses a name or the British royal family chooses a new baby name, that name sends all these signals. And it's true for the names we choose for our children as well.
We'll go to the phones again. Jenny in Bloomington now. Jenny, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to mention that my husband and I named our baby girl, she's 2 now, but we named her a very unique name. We named our daughter after both of her grandfathers. Her name is Charlie Ray, and we wanted to spell it more feminine, of course, because she's a little girl, and so we spelled it Charlie with an I, and we spelled Ray, the feminine form of Ray, R-A-E, but we thought it was very special that a granddaughter be named after her grandfathers. We did get a few raised eyebrows over it, but we think it was very unique, and we noticed the name Charlie coming back over the last couple years because of the popular TV show Good Luck Charlie on Disney, and We, you know, so we thought it would be okay, but we did spell it differently. But I thought it was unique that she's named after her grandfather's.
Interesting. Thanks a lot, Jenny. It seems like names go from male to female, Laura, a lot more than they go the other way.
Traditionally, that has always been the case. There are names today, like Shirley, that we just can't imagine were ever considered male names. But sometimes today, we'll see a celebrity pushing a name back the other way. So the name Ashton, for instance, has started to tip over to the girl side as sort of a variant on Ashley until Ashton Kutcher came along and pushed it back.
We have a tweet from Leah. She says, we named our baby girl Willow. She was born January 31st of this year. Well, congratulations, Leah and Willow. That, I think there was a movie way back when in the 80s, and then Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a key character named Willow. Do you think that's had some resonance there?
Those both did have an effect, and Willow Smith.
Will Smith
and Jada Pinkett Smith's daughter also. There's also a Willow, I believe, in Sarah Palin's family. It's actually one of the names that's most popular in rural areas. For some reason, certain names gravitate more toward cities and more toward the country.
We have a caller now, Gus in Green Bay. Gus, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just wondering, curious about the name Scout for a boy. I'm getting a grandson here maybe this week named Scout, and I've not heard it used before. Is that something more popular these days?
Gus, congratulations on the impending birth of Scout. And that seems like a name I've seen here and there, Laura.
The name Scout is an interesting one because it has a really rugged sound and meaning, and it's close to the boy's name, Scott. So you could picture it being used along with names like Rider and Maverick that are sort of macho for boys. But the Scout that's most prominent was the girl in To Kill a Mockingbird. So you actually see Scout a little bit more often for girls, despite the sound.
Anne in St. Germain emails us, we had our first baby in October. After combing the baby names over and over, we decided to name our boy after my favorite uncle, Murray. I don't think I've ever met someone, she writes, with this name. It has much more meaning to us, meant the world to my uncle. That is a name that I think it's probably fallen into that old-fashioned category for a long time.
It does. You don't even hear it as a surname, which is what it originally was. But I really applaud those parents for going with the name that meant something to them. We're often looking more to a sort of global audience. How will this name come across on a resume? But it's still, you're still part of your family, and that inward-facing meaning is important.
Give us some predictions, Laura, before we're done, please. What's going to be hot in 2014?
I think the name trend maker to look for is the upcoming movie Divergent, based on a really hot young adult novel. The lead characters there are Beatrice and Tobias, who go by Triss and Four. I think that's likely to be the hit maker of the year.
And those are, again, that's in the category of names that you might have named somebody anyway. It's not a really bizarre fantasy world kind of name.
They're absolutely traditional names, but names that maybe wouldn't have come to mind until you see that movie.
Well, Laura, you and I may have been named after the same show. I was supposedly named after Dick Van Dyke's character, Rob, on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and he was married to Mary Tyler Moore's character, Laura.
So Rob and Laura Petrie, the perfect couple of our generation.
And I was also named after the greatest Detroit Red Wings hockey player of all time. I'm happy with Rob and not Gordy.
Well, I live in Boston, so I'm not going to even begin to get into that.
You won't dignify that. Laura, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure.
That's Laura Wattenberg. She's the creator of BabyNameWizard.com. She's got a book of the same name, but without the .com. Coming up after the news, we'll hear some of the stories of Syrian refugees escaping their country's civil war and the impact that's having on the region. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.